It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret and Veronica Ricker will be back tomorrow. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get a few marriage lessons courtesy of Jane Austen's book, Pride and Prejudice.
But first, it's safe to say that nobody looks forward to the flu season. Regardless, the season is on the way. And experts say it's already started here in Wisconsin.
Here to give us a heads up on what we can expect this season and how best to protect ourselves is Nasia Safdar. She's the medical director for infection control at UW Hospital and Clinics and associate chief of staff for research at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital. Nasia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So the flu is already here in Wisconsin, you say. How widespread is it so far?
You know, I think it's been a slow start to the season. We're not seeing a widespread activity at the moment, but this is how it typically begins. So this actually would be a good time to start discussing preventive measures rather than when the season is fully underway. Mm.
So there's always some confusion about what's a cold and what's the flu. I think people toss around the term the flu a little bit too casually. How can we tell the difference and when we have the flu?
So the common cold, you know, is a very mild illness. You typically don't get very high fevers. You don't get the muscle aches. You don't get the headache. You might have a little sore throat. But the flu is something that people will say, you know, I was feeling perfectly well, and then all of a sudden I just felt awful. It's the only thing that, you know, if you're talking to somebody who's never taken a day off from work, well, if they get the flu, they will be taking those days off because it's just impossible to even get going. So it's not really a subtle illness. It hits you like a thunderclap and you feel really sick with it.
Mm. What are some of the symptoms?
So high fever, cough, and headache are the big ones. Many people will get sore throat. Some people, like we saw with the pandemic, will also get GI symptoms, but it's not a predominant feature of it. So the whole term, you know, stomach flu is really a misnomer because it's not really influenza when you're getting the nausea, vomiting that's associated with other viral infections. And then muscle aches is usually a predominant feature of it.
Do we know which strands of the flu are going around this year?
Well, I think it's early to say, just because activity is pretty low. But what's in the influenza vaccine is based on the best guess of people as they were thinking about what sort of strains should go in the vaccine. So season to season, the match of the vaccine with what's circulating really varies. But I think as it gets underway, we'll be able to get a better idea of that.
There are some changes to the flu vaccine this year. What are some differences that they've made to this year's vaccine?
Well, I think this is an exciting time for influenza vaccine development because we have a couple of new flu vaccines. There's one that is manufactured completely independent of chicken eggs. Most influenza vaccines have a requirement that they be developed in fertilized chicken eggs, which makes it very difficult, you know, causing production shortages because you have to depend on the supply of eggs. But one influenza vaccine is using recombinant technology and does not use eggs at all in its production. So that's a significant advance. Its effect seems to be similar to the other influenza vaccines that were already available. And so the egg allergy business doesn't apply anymore to this particular one. There is also a new high dose, which was also available last year, but it's called Fluzone High Dose. And that has more antigen in it than a regular flu vaccine. So the rationale for that is that as people get older, so age 65 or older, their ability to respond to the influenza vaccine becomes diminished. And this high-dose vaccine, which is more antigen, gives you presumably more protection, but definitely gives you more of an antibody response with really very few additional side effects. A little bit more pain is the only thing that's been reported, but it's pretty well tolerated. And then the last thing is that some influenza vaccines this season have four influenza viruses instead of three. So these are the quadrivalent vaccines. They have two influenza A viruses and two influenza B viruses, so expected to provide additional protection. One thing I should also mention is, you know, most influenza vaccines are administered, the ones that are inactivated are administered into the muscle as an intramuscular shot, which causes some pain and a risk for blood clot for people who might have bleeding disorders, for example. But there's another kind of flu vaccine, which is called an intradermal vaccine. So that just goes in the skin and not in the muscle, and would be an option for people that have concerns about getting intramuscular shots.
So you had mentioned earlier that in drug development that it's often a scientist's best guess as to which strains of the flu are going to be going around each year. How do scientists go about making those predictions?
So So it's based upon what was circulating last year or the year before. So looking at, you know, both southern hemisphere data, because their seasons are obviously the complete opposite of ours. So looking at what was circulating there, what was circulating the year before, and then there's a large high-level committee that decides internationally and nationally what should go into the influenza vaccine, such that all the vaccines that are subsequently manufactured have the same, you know, types of strains in them.
Well, let's talk about who should be vaccinated and maybe who shouldn't be. Let's start there, actually. Is there anyone for whom the vaccine is not recommended?
Well, it's a really small group. You know, anybody who has had, there is an association between influenza vaccine and Guillain-Barré syndrome. So anybody who has had Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a neurologic disorder that developed in temporal relationship to when they got the vaccine, should never get the influenza vaccine again. It used to be that any egg allergy would be a contraindication, but now I think with these new production techniques, that is not so much not an absolute contraindication anymore, at least. And then anybody that has a severe anaphylactic reaction to any component of a vaccine should not get it. But that's really the very small minority of the population, and everybody over the age of 6 months should be vaccinated annually, with these rare exceptions that I've just said.
I'm sure you run into people who say, I'm perfectly fine and healthy. I have a strong immune system. I don't need to be vaccinated. What do you say to someone with that outlook?
Well, you know, I think we share the data with them. If you think about the pandemic, it really was the young, healthy people that were getting influenza and becoming very sick from it. So we share the data and we try to convince them based on the literature. But you're right, there are some people that will probably not want to get the influenza vaccine for one reason or the other. So our best strategy is to just share the safety, share the activity data with them, and then see if they'll change their mind.
Do you actually get the flu from the flu shot? Many people will say that they start experiencing some of the symptoms of flu after they've gotten vaccinated.
So the flu vaccine cannot give you, the inactivated flu vaccine cannot give you influenza. So the flu shot, because it's all inactivated vaccine. So the reasons why some people think they may have the flu is either it's coincidental. You know, a lot of viruses are circulating in that year, and you're certainly entitled to get any one of those other ones, which may be confused with influenza. Some people will get a low-grade fever and achiness at the arm site where they get the vaccine, and they may confuse that with influenza symptoms. But there isn't any way that you can get influenza from the vaccine that's the shot.
So are there any indicators so far about how bad the flu season will be this year?
Well, no, I think it certainly hasn't come in with a bang yet, so that at least is good. We're seeing the usual kind of slow rise. It usually peaks in January or February, and I think that's what we're likely to see. There was a concern early on in the season about, you know, not influenza necessarily, but other viruses, respiratory viruses that cause illnesses that could be confused with influenza. So more virulent types, like the MERS respiratory virus from Saudi Arabia, for example, that there was concern that it might come to the U.S. or be affecting people here. So that hasn't come to pass, which is really good. So I think hopefully this will be an influenza season, not worse than the usual.
So besides the flu shot, is there anything else we can or should do to protect ourselves?
Well, I think the mainstay is really the vaccine. One could say, you know, that you want to keep your distance from people who have influenza, but that's easier said than done, because most of the time transmission will happen even before you get symptoms, and it's too late to really do that. So hand hygiene and respiratory etiquette helps against all viruses, really, including influenza. And then for healthcare workers especially, they should not be coming into work when they're sick, so as to protect their patients from getting it.
Well, Nasia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nasia Safdar is the Medical Director for Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics and Associate Chief of Staff for Research at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital.
Coming up, we'll find out what the literary classic Pride and Prejudice can teach us about marriage. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This year marks the 200th anniversary of the publication of Pride and Prejudice. And while it's been adapted many times, often to varying results, That original book stands as a true classic.
And our next guest says that despite its age and often romanticized adaptations, Jane Austen's classic book can still teach us a lot about marriage.
We're joined now by Karen Swallow Pryor. She is a professor of English at Liberty University. And we've got a link to her piece, I Learned Everything I Needed to Know About Marriage from Pride and Prejudice, on the Central Time Facebook page. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to kind of start with a real basic question here, because over the years, of course, there have been many books written about love and marriage. What is it about Pride and Prejudice that 200 years later is still a book that people want to pick up and read?
Someone just tweeted that question to me today, and my answer was, it's universal truth. an allusion, of course, to the famous first line, which is satirical, but even so, I think that is the timelessness of the novel, that even though it takes place in a world so seemingly different from ours, it still contains many universal truths about the human condition and human relationships, especially love and marriage.
Now, Pride and Prejudice is one of those books we're all supposed to have read, and some of us did and some of us didn't, I imagine. But my question for you is, when did you first realize that this was a book that really retained its relevance to you? Was it the first time you read it, or did it take a while to sink in?
The first time I read it, and I have found this is a common experience, I read it in high school, and I really think that the satire is so subtle and so nuanced that most high school students, at least in my case, it was far beyond me. I thought it was the most boring novel ever written, and I was a voracious reader. So it wasn't really until, I believe it was graduate school, when I read it again, probably for the third time, and studied it closely, that I really began to appreciate its satire. I do love satire. And then even more times reading it and teaching the novel to college students, I think, is when I really began to see more of its real-life application.
So it's not a book that really might sink in at first blush for everybody. And for those of our listeners who may not have read Pride and Prejudice, and, you know, we don't have a lot of time, and it's a big book, and a lot of moving parts to it, could you just sort of summarize the plot in a nutshell for us?
Sure. I think the original title Austen gave it, First Impressions, is a good entry into it. The main character is Elizabeth Bennet. She's a smart, sassy girl who has an independent spirit and is very perceptive. And her mother is determined to get her and her unmarried sisters married off because their family fortune is about to go to another branch of the family, and they have no living. And she first, she basically meets two men, and she is taking pride in her own perceptiveness about people, and falls for the wrong one initially, and misjudges the first one. And of course, like all classical comedies, it ends with the marriage of her marriage to the right person for her.
So lots of focus on class, lots of focus on wealth, and of course that marriage theme runs sort of throughout the book. And I want to talk about some of the various lessons that you say can be still learned today, even 200 years down the road. Is there one that you would pick out as sort of an overriding lesson that we can focus on?
Well, there are so many, but I think the one thing that really is most timeless about this is that is the last point that I make in the article, is that you know, there is, I don't believe that there is any one right person for anyone, or is there such a thing as a soulmate. That's a romantic idea, and I like Austen, dismiss romanticism, but I believe that there are better marriage partners and marriage choices for us, and that there are different kinds of love. And what Elizabeth Bennet learns through the course of the novel, through her own experiences and watching the marriages around her, is that the best marriage is one that challenges both partners to grow. It's a marriage of equals. And of course, equal can mean different things, but in Elizabeth Bennet's case, it means equality of spirit and perceptiveness and strength of character. And so when she ends up with, the famous Mr. Darcy, he is someone who is a good match for her, and they will make each other into better people.
But
I think that's something we can all benefit from today.
But at the same time, there's room for both of them to grow within that relationship. And, you know, I have to say that seems awfully far-sighted for 1813.
Oh, absolutely. And because, you know, Austen herself never married, and, you know, and there are elements of her biography that indicate that she had the opportunity, but she was a little bit like Elizabeth Bennet and simply refusing to settle for anyone who would do less than that for her to help her grow as a person. So she was very much ahead of her time. But of course, this was a period in which the whole understanding of marriage and the purpose of marriage was coming under question because of the rise of the individual and changes of the modern age.
One of the other points you focus on, I think, is a point that a lot of people can relate to who are married. You really do marry a family, not just a person. And, you know, sitting here in 2013, I think there are a lot of married people in the audience nodding as they hear that.
Yes, and that forms one of the central conflicts of the novel, because at first Elizabeth is very insulted that Darcy judges her by her family, because her mother is embarrassing and her father has been neglectful of rearing his daughters and sort of reining them in, and Darcy is of an upper class and he is hesitant to embrace a family like that. And at first Elizabeth is offended, but then she realizes that, you know, family does matter and that there are obstacles to be overcome. And so Darcy ends up not rejecting Elizabeth for that, but they both have to be realistic about the limitations and the faults of their family so that they can overcome them and live with them. You know, more and more today with the aging of the population, everyone's living longer, and that means that our family relationships are lasting longer, too. And that's a good thing, but that can mean that, you know, we really have to be realistic about the people who are going to be part of our lives through our marriage choice.
And I have to say, you know, a lot of people say Pride and Prejudice is sort of a romanticized view of things, but as you outlined that sounds awfully realistic and awfully practical to me.
Right. And of course, the films have really tended to emphasize the romantic elements of the story, but the novel itself is very satirical, very circumspect, and very dialectic in a sense. It's not just simply telling us what to think, but the style of the narration, the discourse of the narrator requires us to be a little bit more judgmental and to be perceptive in the same way that Elizabeth Bennet is. And so it's a little more sophisticated than a lot of the film adaptations would lead us to believe.
Here's another lesson that you outline in your piece. You can judge a man by the size of his library. You're going to need to outline that for me.
Well, it just in just about all of Austen's novels, and as in many of the novels of the time, the family library was an important part of an estate, and books were just coming into circulation, and so it was becoming a measure of one's success as well as a measure of one's rootedness and tradition to have a well-stocked library. And so to an intellectual mind like Elizabeth Bennet and other characters in her novels, a well-rounded, broad-minded man was going to have a good library. And so that does come up in Pride and Prejudice, and that was just one of my humorous points. I don't think that literal point is important today, but I think what the library symbolizes in that world, a broad-mindedness, a response against our tendency toward provincialism, regardless of our age and location, I think that's still something important to look for in a marriage partner.
And another point that you bring up, the best marriage is balance, prudence and passion.
Yes. I think we live in an age where we tend to over-romanticize things, or we tend to be overly practical. And really, I think, as most of us who've been married for a long time know, that we really it's a struggle to simply find the proper balance. We certainly want to have passion and be attracted to the person that we marry, but that's not enough. You know, I teach college students, and I have the opportunity to give them personal advice from time to time, and that is one of the things that I say over and over again, that love is not enough, that there needs to be a good match, there needs to be some realism and some long-term similar commitments and values.
We're running out of time here, so I hate to drop this one on you for the last question, but do you think these lessons are going to continue to apply into the future for another 200 years? Will we be having this same discussion in 2213?
I absolutely think so. I think there are things about the human condition and human relationships that never change, and that's what makes Austen so great, is she was able to tap into those, and I'm sure we'll be reading her 200 years from now and enjoying her.
And in the meantime, everybody go read Pride and Prejudice.
There absolutely.
Karen, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Karen Swalla Pryor is a professor of English at Liberty University, and we've got a link to her piece, I Learned Everything I Needed to Know About Marriage from Pride and Prejudice, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Rob and Veronica are back, and they'll take a look at some of the lost words in the English language and why they should make a comeback.
They'll also be talking with a guest who says the most creative and at the same time the most destructive cultural force in the modern era is the idea of the individual exclusive ownership of land.
And they'll find out why some diseases are neglected when it comes to new vaccine development, even though people around the world are still suffering from them.
This is Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about cider heritage right here in Wisconsin. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. America's first drink has been enjoying a renaissance in recent years as more artisans are making and more people are drinking hard apple cider.
On a windy fall day, Deirdre Birmingham takes us on a walk through her cider orchard near Blanchardville.
I'm Deirdre Birmingham, and I own the cider farm near rural Hollandale. And I'm the chief executive orchardist here. My husband is the CTO, which is our chief tractor officer, since I break it and he repairs it. Cider came over with people who emigrated here first, and that was from England. And they brought with them apple trees, apple seeds. A lot of that was apples for drinking. It wasn't apple pie so much that they were after. And in fact, it was safer to drink than the water in the earliest days. There weren't sanitary systems, so you were at risk just drinking water. But then as people started moving, you know, west of the Mississippi, around that time you also had a lot of German immigration. And then Prohibition came along, and orchards that had been developed for cider apples were cut down. And they started calling apple juice then cider. So that was kind of the end of cider as part of our culture. And now it's coming back, and people are discovering what our early American presidents enjoyed so much. John Adams was known to drink a tankard every morning, felt that was good for his health. I don't practice that myself, but I might have my little tankard in the evening. Cider apples are categorized into four groups, and one is your sweets, another one is your sharps, and those would be tart apples, so they're high in acid, like a Macintosh. Another is bittersweet, so the bitter means it has tannins, and then it's low in acid. Then you have bitter sharps that are both high in acid and in tannins. I have about a total of 12 varieties. Two of those being the U.S. disease-resistant cultivars, and then the others being the nine English and one French variety. So we still have a few apples up higher on the trees that I'll be coming through with the ladder to get as we just kind of finish up things. Otherwise, we're finishing our harvest of Liberties and our English cider apples. We just finished harvesting. The latest maturing one was Dabinet. Chisel Jersey is another one from the Jersey region of England. And so we just finished those late ones last week. Ciders are typically a blended product. So doing a single varietal cider is not the norm. The norm is to do a blend. There's a lot of art to it, just like there is to wine making. And in the U.S., there are starting to be some very nice, finely crafted ciders. So soon in the liquor sections, we'll be seeing a cider section. And that's what we need. We need more and more cider makers so that now you not just see wine or beer, you see cider.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
And here with us to talk more about our cider heritage and our cider future is Dan Bussey. He is an apple historian and orchard manager for the Seed Savers Exchange. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start by talking about a little bit about the history of cider, because I have to say, this was news to me, knowing that cider was as big as it was. It's always been around, but in my lifetime anyway, it's always been just sort of a minor player. It's been one tap in a land of many taps.
Yes. Cider has had a long history in this country, and especially it came over from Europe, where it was developed there. I don't know at what point in time. I know the early Romans and Greeks had cider available. It was a very popular beverage, and I remember during the Hundred Years' War between England and France, cider really came into its own, because wine from France was obviously very difficult to get a hold of, and so cider was made into the beverage that was politically correct to drink.
And as I understand it, here in the United States, cider was popular in part because apples were easy to grow.
Yes, apples could be grown in so many different places compared to until there was enough cultivatable land to be able to grow grain. Apples were much easier to grow, and within a few years you could have a decent crop. Most apples in this country were fairly nasty to eat, but the cider they could make was the beverage of choice.
And when you say the beverage of choice, was it the beverage of choice for everyone? Did families drink cider? We heard in the Wisconsin Life piece that one of the issues was that water was not necessarily safe to drink, and presumably something alcoholic like cider might have been.
Oh, it was much safer, actually. There were a lot of areas where the water was polluted badly, with the amount of animals and things that were pastured usually near most streams. A lot of water was not very safe. And so it was considered a healthful beverage, even for children to have at once upon a time. Most alcoholic ciders made in the early days were 6% or less, and so they weren't terribly alcoholic. But later on, that did change, and therefore it became a problem as it was more fortified. At that point in time, then ciders were not looked upon quite as readily as they did before.
And so then what happened to ciders that they sort of disappeared from the landscape?
Well, as I think more immigrants from like Germany and other areas where beer drinking was a little bit more advanced in the culture, beer ended up taking over, I think, as the beverage of choice. Up until 1930, apple cider, meaning hard cider and or sweet cider, was the most popular beverage. After Florida was developed and oranges were allowed to grow, orange juice eventually replaced apple juice and apple cider as the beverage, the type of fruit, or as far as a fruit beverage.
Now, the ciders that we're seeing today, all of a sudden you're starting to see them pop up all over the place. Is it the same cider we're drinking today that we may have been drinking 200 years ago?
In essence, yes, it is. A true artisanal cider is one of the most simple beverages that you could ever find. It's just basically apple juice, sometimes a small amount of sugar to augment the amount of alcohol it can potentially produce for shelf life, basically, and yeast, the Saccharomyces strain of yeast. That's it. It's simpler to make, actually, than beer.
So when you're talking about making cider, what kind of apples are good for that? And are there any sort of heritage apples that are being used for cider?
Oh, there's a long history of heritage apples. Typically, a lot of the crab varieties were ones that were the most popular. One of Jefferson's favorite cider varieties was the Hughes crab, Hughes Virginia crab, also as it's known by, and another variety called Taliaferro. And there was Campfield, and there was a number of other apples that were well known for cider. And they tended to be small apples, and ones that you really wouldn't want to eat. They were not very tasty, but they had a lot of sugar embedded in them, and a lot of the flavors that when you ferment those sugars away have the background characteristics of the bittersweet and bittersharp flavors, as Deirdre was mentioning, that give your cider character and body.
You know, we hear a lot about home brewers today and even people who make wine at home. Is this cider something where people are starting to pick that up and be making a lot of cider at home as well?
Yes, they're finding that it's such a simple beverage to make, and it's so pleasant to have. It's very refreshing. It can be put away and stored for a long period of time. Granted, the only issue is that you have a fairly short window of time when you have apples available that you can actually make cider.
And so finally, what would you recommend, say somebody's listening to this discussion and they may have seen a bottle of cider somewhere, but they've never tried it before? What sorts of things should they be thinking about as they try it? And what would you recommend to that person?
Well, there are getting to be a greater amount of varieties available. What I'm seeing, though, is a lot of the mass, the larger breweries that are starting to carry lines of cider. And the problem with this is not really a true artisanal cider. Many of these type of ciders are made with upwards of 65% of just the sugar water solution and 35% of apple flavoring. That way you get reproducible results. The true artisanal ciders are made with a good blend of apples. Very seldom are they single varietals, but a good mix that gives your cider character and body that is just nothing but apple juice.
And it sounds more like almost a wine thing where it's going to differ from year to year.
Oh, yes, exactly. That's what a true cider should be. It should be very different. Last year was a very dry year, and so I consider that a very vintage year for our cider quality. The size of the apples was kind of small, but the sugars in them was very concentrated. And the quality of the cider that I was able to put away last year, I think, was just phenomenal. Years like this where there's a little bit more moisture, it's good, but not quite the same. Each year should be different. And that's the best thing about it.
And this is a silly question, but I just have to ask it. How long does cider keep? Is it like wine where it gets better with age, or you got a window there?
A small window, yes. You can usually keep bottled ciders for literally years before they tend to maybe lose some of the flavors. You don't typically have, like with wines, that sometimes they improve that much with age. They're generally good within the first couple of years.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
That was Dan Bussey, apple historian and orchard manager for the Seed Savers Exchange.
Coming up next, we'll check the headlines and then we'll talk about the role of the Vatican in a modern globalized world. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Jean Purcell. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up in the next hour, we'll take a look at some potential rifts in the Democratic Party.
First, though, the Holy See is the longest surviving monarchy in the Western world, and the U.S. is the oldest modern democracy. Our next guest says despite scandals and the first papal resignation in centuries, the Vatican plays a larger role in global politics than most would give it credit.
Francis Rooney was the American ambassador to the Holy See from 2005 to 2008 and is the author of The Global Vatican, an inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. Ambassador Rooney, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Cynthia and Jean. I appreciate the chance to be on.
Well, first, let's just establish, what is the Holy See as opposed to the Vatican? What's the distinction?
Well, the Holy See, the term comes from the Latin holy seat, and it refers to the locus of authority, power, and influence of the church in the world, personified by the Pope and the organization around the Pope, which is called the Curia. The Vatican is a 109-acre piece of land which was given to the Holy See by the government of Italy in settlement of the taking of the Papal States by the Lateran Treaty in 1929. So if it were just the Vatican, the sovereignty would not be nearly as relevant and influential in the world as is the combined power and moral authority of the church.
Okay. So you say that the power and influence of the Vatican, though, is underestimated on a global political level. How much influence does the Vatican actually have in global politics today?
Well, hopefully the book will elucidate some instances of that. The Holy See has been involved in great many diplomatic initiatives over the years. I mean, the work of Pope John Paul, symmetrical work of Pope John Paul alongside Margaret Thatcher and Reagan in bringing down communism in Eastern Europe is pretty well known. In fact, I put a quote in the book from Gorbachev where he says, all that happened in Eastern Europe would have been impossible without the Pope. But there are many less well-known and equally important Holy See diplomatic initiatives which have been carried on oftentimes with very little public awareness during World War II, during the Cold War, when I was there working to unify the Christians in Lebanon to oppose Hezbollah, and they continue to work today. They're trying to work in Syria to protect the persecuted Christians and to call for a new concept of citizenship in Syria, which really could be said about the Middle East, to be inclusive of all minorities.
Well, and the Holy See is a permanent observer at the United Nations. Can you talk about what that means and why that's so?
Well, they have been a permanent observer for many years, and what it does, it allows them to participate in all discussions, but not to vote. And I think that's an important distinction for the Holy See, because you know part of their unique sovereignty comes from their soft power, their power of moral suasion and the influence on the basis of their merits of their arguments. And there are many, many issues that it's probably better for the Holy See to conserve its authority and not be drawn into a lot of hegemonic back and forth among secular powers, which goes on a lot of times at the UN, and allows them to remain focused on those fundamental principles that are the cornerstone of their democracy, or diplomacy, I'm sorry.
Well, how has the relationship between the Vatican and the U.S. changed in modern times?
Well, it's kind of waxed and waned, you know. I mean, certainly during World War II, President Roosevelt exploited the neutrality of the Holy See quite effectively to the benefit of advancement of U.S. interests. Certainly during the Cold War, many other things happened of a similar nature through the end of communism. Right now, which also shows that, and then in 1983, see, President Reagan could get the an ambassador-level mission established, which shows that the anti-Catholicism, which was so rampant in the 50s and 60s, you know, that President Kennedy had to deal with, that President Truman encountered when he tried to appoint an ambassador, Ambassador General Mark Clark, that had evaporated and that the climate was ready to take advantage of the role the Holy See could play in the world.
Well, I would love to learn more about your time as the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. I want to ask you, what was your relationship like with Pope Benedict?
Well, it's great to know a pope, you know.
And how many people can say that?
That's true. And, you know, it's surprising. There's been so many things written about him being a severe German, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact of the matter is he is very warm, engaging, has a wry sense of humor. He's old, you know, feeble, which is why he resigned. But he is so brilliant and so deep with a penetrating intellect. It was a real pleasure and honor to get to meet him and to discuss policy objectives with him.
Were you surprised that he resigned? I mean, you say he was old and feeble, but you know, that's not uncommon. For centuries, the pope served until he passed on.
Well, I was surprised when it happened because I just wasn't expecting it. But I'm not surprised because the climate and conditions existed to nurture that decision. I don't think I think that the example of Pope John Paul's last years, where he was very feeble, showed a lot of people, you know, that there's a risk of having a almost incapacitated pope in an era of great complexity around the world. And the other thing is Pope Benedict, if you read his writings and everything, is truly one of the most humble people in the world. And it doesn't surprise me that he would give up the power and the attributes of being pope in a nanosecond if he felt it was the best thing for the work of the church in the world.
Well, and meanwhile, Pope Francis has made some waves around the globe as he makes statements about world affairs and societal values and things. And people like to infer what he means by that and whether it's an indication of the forthcoming agenda of the Catholic Church. How has the Vatican's image changed, perhaps, since Pope Francis, since his papacy has begun?
Well, I agree with you. I think there's no doubt that there's been a great enthusiasm on the part of Americans and many people around the world for his kind of message of no judgment, tolerance, etc. in church matters. In the diplomatic realm of things, I think that's also related to his focus on social work, because you know you can't have conditions for a stable democracy without a middle class and people that have jobs and people that have education and mobility. And The needs that he's called for are tie right into fundamental diplomatic objectives that align with the United States. I'm very encouraged by his new world candor. To have a pope that's from our part of the world and not so Eurocentric, I think, is going to be a great thing.
Well, you know, there are a vast array of religious beliefs across the globe, and yet the Vatican has great influence on global politics. I'm wondering, what do you say to people, though, who believe that the United States shouldn't have diplomatic relationships with a religious body?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, you know, the First Amendment doesn't really have to do with the U.S. diplomatic mission to the Holy See, because the diplomatic mission of the Holy See is there to promote American diplomatic interests, not deal with the religious aspects of the establishment of religion or the encroachment of religion in the states and all that kind of stuff. So they're really two completely distinct concepts. Second, the fact that we are the only country founded on the inalienable rights of man, directly, you know, the natural law theories of John Locke, and that we have enshrined religious freedom in our Constitution before anybody else thought of doing that, is really makes us a natural partner for the Holy See. You know, we've had, since Woodrow Wilson for sure, we've had a foreign policy that was replete with reference to promoting human dignity and spreading freedom. Now, you can't always do it the same way all the time through the long history of our diplomacy, but those are principles that we're always attuned to. And as such, the Holy See is squarely in our sights as a potential partner and a sovereign entity with whom there's great symmetry with the United States values.
Well, you wrote in your book that people who operate on a millennial time scale, like the Vatican does, may not feel the pressure to move quickly and shift with the times so much as Americans would want. Do you think Pope Francis will shift the time scale, so to speak, or will he continue to use precedent and continuity when setting the Church's agenda?
Well, I think that in the diplomatic realm, the fundamental principles of Holy See diplomacy will not change. The reason the Holy See is in the diplomatic business is the same now as it's been for thousands of years, to promote human dignity, to promote freedom, to promote the conditions for a better living environment for the people of the world. And as such, I think his message may change, like some of his messages have changed here recently, but the fundamental principles will be the same. And I'm hoping that because he's such a great communicator, he will be able to articulate these positions in a much more broad and deep manner, where more people understand them.
Well, in our last minute or so, I wanted to ask you, you see an important place for the Vatican in the future of international politics. What does that role look like to you?
Well, I think it goes back to the soft power concept. You know, the Holy See is not a hegemonic power. They don't have any territory to speak of. And what they do have is the moral persuasion of their voice. And we're in a world now with asymmetrical conflicts all around the world. Some are gangs, some are bands of robbers and thugs, some are religiously or culturally based, like is radical Islamic gangs or Al-Qaeda or something like that. And we need the voice of the Holy See weighing in as the consummate moral authority, not for Christians, not for Catholics, but for the world.
Well, Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
That was Ambassador Francis Rooney, former American ambassador to the Holy See. His new book is called The Global Vatican, an inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. You can learn more about his book on our Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll take time out for a look at the news, and then we'll be back with a look at the Common Core curriculum in Wisconsin. We've been hearing an awful lot about the Common Core in the last couple of weeks, and we're going to be beginning a series here on Wisconsin Public Radio on that. Gets underway in just a few minutes. This is Central Time.